that doesn't have any control. And in fact, I thought that was a brilliant idea of mine. And then I saw an article in the Encyclopedia Judaica, Louis Rabinowitz had the same idea. Luz of the spine, a bone which, according to the rabbis, is to be found at the base of the spine, in addition to the 18 vertebrae, called the Luz Shebashidra. It is indestructible and is the source of the future resurrection of the body. And then he goes on to discuss this. There's no scientific basis for the legend. It may be connected with the statement that in the second city of Luz, which was still identified as existing in Talmudic times as a place where the Caleb, the blue dye for the ritual fringes, was manufactured, the angel of death had no permission to pass through. So what I thought was a brilliant original idea was in fact already patented. But what is interesting is that we saw in the Gemara last time, and the Gemara in Sota says that when the Viscanium became sick and tired of life, they would go out of the walls of the city where the angel of death could overtake them. The Medrash Rabbah brings this passage in a slightly different form. It says, Haskenim Sheba Ma'osin Lahem Kevan Shehem Zkenim Harveh Motziim Otam Chutz L'choma V'heim Etim. So according to the Medrash Rabbah, it isn't a purely voluntary act on the part of the ancient when they get sick of life, but rather that past a certain age, apparently, they
were encouraged,
were let taken out of the wall, and they would die. So that's one thing that I wanted to mention.
A little bit of a parallel to the Abrahamic flood.
Yeah, but here
an isolated place where
right, immune. Right. Also, I wanted to mention two things which have nothing to do with last week's shiur, but which I encountered in conjunction with preparing this week's shiur, and have to do with things that we were studying 2 or 3 years ago. If you remember the tshuva that I wrote about 3 or 4 years ago on the electronic card key, where my basic position was that the use of electrical appliances per se is not prohibited on Shabbat. What's prohibited is either the turning on of a light or the performance of some work via the electrical appliance, but the electrical appliance itself, by virtue of simply being the use of electricity, was not prohibited. I wanted, in that connection, to cite two things that I came across, I was unaware of, one of which I maybe should have been aware of, but wasn't, but the other of which I couldn't have been aware of. One is a tshuva of Rav Moshe, more or less close to the last year of his life. What year is this? Tashim and Malik, not so far. I mean, 1981, I guess. The guy went in 1985. ובדבר רופא שומר תורה שמטפל בשבת בבית חולים עם חולה שיש בו סכנה בשבת ומוכרח לשלוח דמו לבדוק במעבדה. He has to send the blood to the laboratory וצריך לכתוב שם החולה על הנייר שמצורף להכלי שהאדם בו כדי שידעו על איזה חולה. He has to write down the name of the patient on the label or the accompanying slip. ושואל איך יותר טוב אם לכתוב בשינוי וקיצור שאפשר לדע מזה על איזה חולה הוא שצריך לעשות מעשה כתיבה על כל עוד באות שלי right with his left hand or in some unusual with a שינוי או שיש פס שכתוב בו באותיות בולטות שם החולה שמניחים את הפס תחת הנייר מושכים המכונה על הנייר some kind of a template that you run the thing over. By ידי זה יוצא דיול מהמכונה מסמן מקום בליטת האותיות, שאולי נחשב זה למעשה אחת, one act as opposed to the writing of many letters, או שיש מכונה שעושה הפעולה בחשמל. You have an electrical printing device, שמעשה האדם רק פעם אחת הדחיקה בכפתור, אחר שאני אקשה מקודם את הנייר. Okay? And he discusses which of the three is that's best to be done. אבל לכאורה היותר נכון הוא דרך שלישית. על ידי המכונה שעושה על ידי החשמל. ולכאורה אין שם שום איסור דאורייתא נעשה על ידי אדם. זה מה שהאדם צריך לדחוק על הכפתור, הרי בזה לבד אין כאן עשיית מלאכה, כי אף שכל דפיקה בכפתור החשמל נוציא ניצוצות, אין בזה שום חשיבות עשיית אש, כל זמן שלא הדליק מהניצוצות שיוצאים איזה דבר, ונודעתי מהמומחים בעניין חשמל שאין ניצוצות הללו שיוצאים בשעת הדפיקה בכפתור עושים כלום לחשמל, ואין ידוע להם שום צורך בזה. אם כן, מסתבר שאין בזה איסור דאורייתא דמלאכת הברא בזה, שדוחקים על הכפתור החשמל שנעשה למלאכה, ועל כחשמל לפודוק מהחשמל במעליות, בבתים הגבוהים, ובאלו שנעשה בכל מכונות לעשיית מלאכה, צפי וצפי. So he certainly, he is saying that there's certainly no איסור דאורייתא involved in the usage of an electrical appliance, it's leaving open the question of whether there is or is not an איסור דאורייתא involved.
No boner,
no boner, right, any of those.
Actually, they're simple enough to supply people.
Right.
Yeah.
Then, even more to the point, I saw in Asia, which just came out last year, after Rav Shlomo Zalman's death, this is reminiscences of some of his students, this particular one, by Rabbi Halpern. Rabbi Mordechai Halpern. I don't know too. Here, let me just read to you what he writes. Lefnei k'shloshim shana, about 30 years ago, nizdamanti odeni na'ar leveito shel agon of Shlomo Zalman zecha tzadik l'arucha b'inyan halakhti. I had to go to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman's house on some halachic question. במהלך השיחה, איתה הרב את הדברים לדין מכשירים חשמליים בשבת, ושאלני, מה לענות לשואלים על שימוש במכשירים חשמליים מסוימים בשבת? What should I respond to people who ask me about the usage of certain electrical appliances on Shabbat? מצד אחד לדעתו, אין שום איסור להשתמש בהם. There is no reason to prohibit them whatsoever. אולם מעידוך, ציבור שאינו בקי בשילוב של האלקטרוניקה ודקדוקי ההלכה לא יבין את ההבדל בין מכשירים מותרים למכשירים אסורים, ועלולה לצאת תקלה חס ושלום. על שאלתי, מדוע לא לאסור משום כך את השימוש במכשירים האלו? If you feel that there's going to be a problem, that people will not be able to be distinguished between one and the other, he answered, ענה הרב שפתרון כזה מנוגד להלכה. Prohibit something just because other people might be confused is against the halakha. Sha'arei k'shem she'ein roshut lahatir et ha'asur, kach ein roshut lehasor et ha'mutar. V'doreinu ein lanu et ha'samkut l'gzor gzeor kadashem. So his position on this is private, non-published, non-public position on this is identical to the position that I took. Not only is there no isur d'oraita, but there's no isur d'rabanan either, the issue of no lot or molid or things of this nature. And in view of the fact that the social inevitable changes that are brought about by all hotel rooms and pretty soon all apartments and apartment houses will necessitate the use of the heter that I gave, you can see that, again, here's a case of
how would that apply to something like, you know, stepping on a transom, say, get into the hospital and the door?
There's nothing wrong with opening the door.
Nothing wrong.
No, nothing wrong with opening and shutting a door.
Garbage.
Garbage disposal is something wrong with because you're because of the act of grinding itself. In other words, the rule should be, and this is what I indicated in my tshuva, the rule should be that if the act that is performed is itself a malacha, it should be prohibited. Like turning on of a light, the light itself being the of. But if the electrical appliance is not doing anything which in and of itself is prohibited, like a fan, for example, or an electric tonic car key or open car key or opening up a door, any of those acts which you're permitted to do by hand, you're really permitted to do by the use of electricity. So that therefore the criterion should be whether or not the act itself would be permitted if you were going to do it by hand, and if it would be prohibited as a malacha for doing it by hand, then the use of an electrical appliance would be prohibited. That's what I wrote then, and of course I would had no way of knowing this because this is just a few. few months. Okay. Yes?
What rabbi is that?
Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He was the posek in Yerushalayim for the last 4 years. He died last year, and this was some things that were written by his students in memoriam. But what I wrote, I wrote that 2 or 3 years ago.
Alfred was one of the students.
Yeah.
Because I see there's a book, as I was going to say,
correct.
One of, in English, mm-hmm. by him. Mm-hmm.
I don't know him at all. And in general,
his
I don't.
Nephew, actually. He's his nephew.
Your nephew?
Son of a cousin.
Son of a cousin. Okay.
He's a good friend. His father. His father.
All right.
A cutting knife?
If you're allowed to cut, if you're allowed to cut meat by hand, you're allowed to use an electric knife.
That was an old one.
That
was an
old one. Right. That thing we discussed 20 years ago.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all of these are sort of all of these are sort of side issues. Of, okay. Now let us bring ourselves a little bit up to date on this issue of termination of life before I turn the floor over to Dr. Schwab. Okay? The Shotei HaGiborim, we've done this before, but let's just bring ourselves up to date by running through this quickly. The Shotei HaGiborim on Moed Katan writes, "Umikan haya nireh le'esor," from this, that was the statement that one is not allowed to move a dying person, a person who's in the terminal stage of their life, since by simply moving them you may hasten to death. ומכאן היה נראה לאסור מה שנוהגים קצת אנשים כשהמית גוסס ואין הנשמה יכולה לצאת ששומתים הקר מתחתיו כדי שימות מהרה. So a person is trying to die but is not succeeding in it. They pull the pillow out from under his head in order to hasten his death. שאומרים כי יש במיטה נוצות של עופות שגורמים לנפש שלא תצא. Because they believe that the feathers in these pillows had the effect of preventing the soul from escaping. וכמה פעמים צעקתי כחוכיה להסיר, לאסור, I guess you should say, להסיר המנהג הרע. I screamed like a rooster to try to eliminate this particular bad practice. ולא עלה בידי. And I did not succeed in eliminating this practice. והרבותיי חלקו עליו. And my teachers disagreed with me. והרב רב נחמן איש איגרא ז"ל כתב על זה להתיר. And Rav Nathan Ish Igra כתב על זה להתיר. So there was a difference of opinion as to whether you could remove the feathers from under a patient whose gosses is very hard to translate, but someone who's gasping for breath, who's in has the death rattle, I guess, used to be a phrase. And that may be simplest translation, and then he goes on to present the arguments for his view.
Where is that again?
We studied this many times. It's in the Shiltei HaGiborim on the Rif on Moed Katan, the third parak. In my pagination of the Rif, it would be on Daftet Zayin Amud Beis, but we may have a different pagination of the Rif. Okay. Similarly, we have in the Ramah, in Shulchan Aruch, Simon Shin Lamed Tet, V'yesh Omrim, the Ein Chotzin Lo Kever, you're not allowed to dig the grave for a dying person, Af Kish Eino Imo Bavayit, Alachar Shiyamut, V'asur Lachzor Shum Hevel Yod Patuach, Ad Mokav, etc. V'chein Asur Ligrom Lamed Shiyamut Meheva. Similarly, you may not hasten the death of a dying person. Kagon, Misha Hayagoseis Zman Arok, someone who had his death rattles in the terminal stages of life for a long period of time. Velo Yachol Lehipare, is unable to succeed in dying. Asur Lahashmit Hakar Vahateset Mitakta. מכוח שאומרים שיש נוצות מקצת עופות שגורמים זה. וכן לא יזיזנו ממקומם. Similarly, you cannot move the dying person from his place. So he agrees with the position of the Shultei HaGiborim against the Shultei HaGiborim's teachers that you're not allowed to yank the Kohen underneath. V'chein asur l'asum machtechot beit ha'kneset tachat roshov kidei sheyipared. Similarly, you can't put the keys of the shul under his pillow, since they believe that that would also help, once he had the keys to get out, the soul would be able to escape. Aval, im yesh sham davar shegorem ikub yitziat ha'nefesh. On the other hand, if there is something that is preventing the escape of the soul, kugon sheyesh samuch le'oto bayit kol dofek, kugon chotei ve'tziv, if there is a steady noise which is preventing the soul from escaping, Ob sheyesh melach al l'shono, or there was salt placed on the patient's tongue, which was keeping him alive. Ve'elu ma'atim yitziyat ha'nefesh mutar l'hasiro misham. It is permissible to remove those things which are obstructing the death. De'ein bazem ma'aseh klal, ela shemesir hamoneh. There is no act, but one is removing the thing, that, the obstruction. So.
Is he disputing the feather
during the death? The Lavush asks exactly your question. What is the difference between the pillow and the salt? And the Lavush says, let's read what he has to say. Lama asar lahashvit hakar mitachtav mishum netzot. The hatam nami eino oseh klum ela shemesir hamoneya. What's the difference of removing the feathers or stopping the noise or removing the salt? It's sarif kiyun. The efshar shehu mefaresh shesiluk hanotzot mekavin hamita. That it's not, that he believes that the actual yanking of the feathers hastened back. Kloma sheyadua shegam im lo hayu otam notzot tachtav haya ma'arich begesisa. That it wasn't that the feathers themselves were preventing the person from dying. Ela shesgulat hanotzot, the occult properties of the feathers, kachu sheim yizdamein lahem bekar shach sholesh olchev olav umesalkin otam mitachtav be'ei tshugo seis mitatol mitkarevet v'docha. No, what he's trying to look, what the Lavush is saying very simply is that the Ramah as we have it makes no sense, that the only criterion that we can apply is the criterion between passive non-action or even removing of something else or active intervention. And we'll see that there's a possibility of reading the Lavush slightly differently. But this has been a general principle, not only in halacha, but in non-Jewish sources also, that somehow or other there was a difference between an act of hastening death and passive non-action, not doing something which prevents the person from dying.
But the removal of an obstruction is not passive.
Yeah.
The removal
why
of the salt. The stopping of the sound is one thing, but the removal of the salt.
I'm saying, let's agree that this whole issue is problematical, and the very fact that it's problematical works to our advantage. The reason that it works to our advantage is that the criterion of active versus non-active, you're not allowed to do anything to hasten the person's death, but you shouldn't prevent the death by doing something. Passive intervention versus active intervention may have made sense up to 20 or 30 years ago. That is, as an active criterion for distinguishing between how a doctor or someone should act in a given situation, don't intervene. And non-intervention is in itself not a right. That was fine up to the invention of these types of really powerful human interventions in the dying process. The heart-lung machine, for example. a patient comes in a trauma and in some kind of difficult situation, right? If he really is dead or irrevocably going to die, then you certainly don't want to keep him on this machine forever. On the other hand, if you had a rule which says that you're never allowed to take him off the machine, because that would be construed as active intervention, the way you're trying to interpret it, it's you're acting by pulling the plug, then you're not going to put him on the machine in the first place. In other words, the societal effect of abiding by this rule, which says don't actively intervene, is in fact going to have more negative outcomes than positive. In the old days, what it simply meant is don't kill the patient. But today, by having a rule which says that you're not allowed to take a patient off the machine, you're in fact going to kill a lot of patients because you're going to be very hesitant about putting them on the machine in the first place. So therefore, what has to occur is the invention of other clear-cut rules which will apply in modern times, which don't make the distinction depend upon the difference between active and passive. It's not clear to me that we can easily, around this table, formulate such a rule. We can make some attempts at it. But what I'm saying is that it's to our advantage that the Rama is so obscure and the Shilte Agibovim is so obscure that we can work within this framework and change the rules. That's what I'm trying to say. Now, to show you, for instance, an instance of this, we can see how the Aruch HaShulchan reads this this halacha, and then I will roughly tell you how Rabbi Waldenberg reads this halacha, just so that we can bring this up to more recent times. So the Aruch HaShulchan, writing at the end of the last century, "Biur dvarim v'mikodem nitba'er she'ein osin ma'aser she'al yidei ze yiparu mitato k'mo l'shmot hakal mitachta." One can't take any act which will hasten a death. To this he adds that even if it's in the opinion of the doctors that it's a commandment to hasten his death, that he is in the process of dying for a long time, and we see that he's in acute pain, even if this act isn't necessarily part of the within the body of the dying person, I'm numb. And yesh davar min hatzad shema'akev yitziyat hanef. If there's something which is a side cause, an external cause, mutar la'achsiro, the mimanavshach, im ha'ikur mitzad zeh, lama yisbo. If the prevention of the death is from this external cause, why should he suffer? This is not part of his body that's preventing this from staying. And if this external cause is really having no effect whatsoever, then what harm? Halo lo yoil kulum. Vegam hasarat hamelach milshono lo nechshav kemaaseh klal b'nyanua klalhu v'ov d'mestama hinicho laharich chayav. Perhaps, undoubtedly, the salt was placed on this man's tongue in order to keep him alive, in other words, an artificial intervention. And therefore, it is permissible to remove it. And some disagree with this decision of the Ramah. So you can see that the Aruch HaShulchan is beginning to introduce a new principle here, that is, one of a natural process versus an external intervention. Now, how to describe that question?
No, it just seems to be very aggressive to pull the pillow out from underneath somebody's head, as opposed to removing the salt.
Yes, but he says, but the Rama also says that you shouldn't put the keys under the pillow. He also says that. He's
And then it spoke about something like the occult.
also something. It's like you're actively doing something, some kind of superstitious thing.
No, I use the word occult as a translation of sagul, but I mean, I meant occult not necessarily in the meaning of superstitious, but hidden or mysterious or intrinsic. Skula, I don't know how to translate. The simplest translation, the technical translation is occult. If you were dealing with medieval philosophy, then the Aristotelians didn't believe in occult properties, that is, anything that wasn't visible to the senses, and that's the meaning here. But you're right, there's a difference between a violent act and a not-so-violent act, but that's not the line that the Aruch HaShulchan is trying to draw in Rama's interpretation. He's trying to put something a slightly different twist on it, namely something that we would characterize as a natural process, or stopping some intervention which was not part of a natural process. For example, if one simply blindly went straight ahead, one would then conclude from what the Aruch HaShulchan is saying is that in a situation where someone is on a heart-lung machine or is intubated as a respirator or something like that, and you realize that it's absolutely hopeless for him to be able to breathe on his own and survive, then you would be able, according to the Aruch HaShulchan's interpretation, to take him off the respirator, whereas according to the interpretation given by the Lavush or the straight reading of the Rama, you would not be able to actively intervene. Of course, that would then mean that a respirator is... No. My point is, you don't want to have a situation where you're going to say that you shouldn't have put it in the first place. In many cases, you just don't know. I mean, a patient comes to the hospital as a result of some acute accident or an acute disease or something, and he needs to be put on the respirator, and you'll save his life by doing that. Another patient, in superficially seeming the same way, has already undergone such severe internal trauma that he's not going to survive. You don't want to have a rule which tells you that it was wrong to have put him on the respirator in the first place. On the other hand, you can't live with a rule which tells you that the only criterion is between active intervention and passive non-intervention, and therefore once the guy is on the respirator, you'll never be able to take him off. For example,
an issue that comes up not infrequently now with somebody who, as we say, an extremist, which is the Gosse's equivalent in medical department, who's being fed with intravenous fluid just for basic hydration. There comes a time when the family is asked, the doctor has to decide it's time to collect the IV. It's a very difficult decision.
Right. Now, I think that...
Somebody who you know when you remove the ventilator is not going to remain alive.
For example, you might take him off the ventilator and see if he's able to breathe on his own or not.
You see very quickly that...
By that criterion, you did that 1 hour into having the person on the ventilator who was destined to survive.
Right, so this is not a criteria, this is not an absolute criteria. You have to have a whole complex of
these are continuums, and the decisions are not made arbitrarily.
Right, what I'm saying is that the old simple-minded legal criteria no longer applies. And I also said, and I repeat, that it may be that at the end of 3 or 4 hours of work, we will not come up with any clearly formulatable criterion which one can write down easily and apply. But on the other hand, we will come up with some kind of a sense of what responsible action is in this situation. For example, on the issue of removal of fluids, what Shlomo Zalman recommends is gradual removal of fluids. Namely, you don't suddenly cut off the respirator or suddenly cut off the intravenous feeding, which may produce some kind of a shock, or certainly with a respirator, which may in itself terminate, but if gradually take, wean him off. Like, for example, that's what happened in the Quinlan case, right? The doctors weaned against the court ruling, which said that they should immediately turn off the respirator. They instead slowly weaned the patient off the respirator, and she lived, what, another 7 years on her own.
How would you formulate that in terms of the two separate criteria?
Right. It's neither active nor passive, neither natural nor non-natural.
It's begging the question.
It's trying to be realistic about the nature of the questions involved. These questions are just far too complicated to have a black and white answer. On the other hand, with enough experience, one might be able to provide guidelines. What I'm trying to get from this discussion is some kind of guidelines for myself, so that when I get called up in the middle of the night with some kind of a question and I'm unable to think but have to give some kind of advice, I can say something intelligent.
In most of the cases, is there a discrepancy or a wide variation between various doctors' opinions as to when the point would come to remove the patient from the respirator?
Yeah, doctors are also not machines. They each come with their own personal history and religious or spiritual values and ethical values.
Right.
I think the most difficult job in a hospital center these days is not the neurosurgeon or the thoracic surgeon, it's the ethicist.
All right. I don't want to take the floor away from Dr. Schwaber, because let's start to go through these cases, explain the details of the cases to us, explain how you would or someone would respond to these cases, and then let's have some discussion on it.
Okay. Why don't we just take them in order?
Right.
Unless you have a particular
No.
Family practitioner calls you about an 82-year-old woman in a nursing home with severe dementia, meaning that the brain is not working. It was found today.
Wait a minute. Severe dementia means that the woman is crazy.
It means that she's not aware of her surroundings, that she's babbling or that she cannot relate to the environment.
But she's conscious in some sense.
She's conscious.
If you give her a spoon, she will take it in her hand.
She may take it. She may throw it back at you.
Oh, she may throw it back at you out of anger. But
she may even say thank you. She may be yelling out wildly, even though nobody's disturbing her.
Right.
In other words,
she would be someone whom, if they were in a normally healthy body, we would call severely mentally ill, but otherwise physically healthy. This is not the case in this particular woman, but the severe dementia does not mean loss of consciousness or irreversible vegetative state.
The mind is not integrating.
The conscious mind is not integrating, but the lower levels of the mind are, that is, the those portions of the mind that control bodily functions
are working.
Fine.
Found today to be in pulmonary edema. That means a lot of fluid in the lungs. Usually caused by heart failure, but can be caused by other conditions as well. A patient with pulmonary edema is going to be extremely short of breath. This is not after activity, this is just sitting quietly or lying in bed. If you listen to the stethoscope, you hear a lot of gurgling noises, which represent too much fluid in the lungs. The patient's legal guardian is unavailable. The patient had an echocardiogram 5 years ago. That's his way of measuring the effective pumping function of the heart for an episode of fluid retention then, and he's been on Lasix, which is a fluid reducing pill, and digoxin, which is aimed at strengthening the heartbeat ever since. This is a very elderly lady who we know has had heart disease at least going back 5 years, who is now essentially living but without effective brain function, and is now again short of breath with some heart failure causing lung edema. A nursing home patient is 82 years old. This could also be caused by her having aspirated saliva or food or something going down the wrong pipe and setting up the pneumonia in the lungs, which can also cause pulmonary edema. So those are the two usual situations in an 82-year-old nursing home patient. What course should you follow? Rule number one is that if you have a patient who's compos mentis, who's competent, you always first deal with the patient, ask the patient what he or she would like to have done. Generally, we ask patients when they are relatively well to send us written documents known as healthcare proxies or living wills, sort of indicate, you know, if I ever get into this situation where I'm demented and I'm planning a heart failure, please do not intervene, or intervene only thus far. Presumably that did not happen with this lady. But this lady did establish a legal guardian who was unavailable. So that you can't, at the time you need the advice of the legal guardian, get it from somebody who represents the patient. And so what do you do? Well, I don't know that there's any official rule about it, but I can tell you what I would do in this situation. And that is I would treat this patient's pulmonary edema. I would get her into the hospital if necessary. I would give her fluid, diuretic pills to get rid of the excess fluid. I would give her oxygen. I would do an x-ray to see whether or not she has pneumonia as opposed to heart failure. Johnson, essentially try and stabilize her condition, and in the process send feelers out to where this legal guardian might be to see how I could find the legal guardian and what he or she would have to say about the future approach to management. Mm-hmm. So the assumption is that the patient has the right to live. Mm-hmm. This patient does not choose to die, and we don't know anything about it. And the role of the doctor
right. I would think that this would more or less be a unanimous view of a lot of people who would be asked on this particular question. The fact that the woman is demented has no bearing on the treatment of her physical ailments at this particular point.
What doctors would you know who would bet you would alter it?
Not at the people that I'm accustomed to working with. I would imagine no, if I can conjure up, you know,
in Holland?
No, somewhere else, you know, maybe in some remote town in Massachusetts where there's a doctor visiting a nursing home with he or she and he sees 200 nursing home patients a day. That's the nature of the practice. These people are in isolated, frequently run-down institutions. Nobody has come to see them that the doctor or the nurse know about in the past 3 years. The visitor or anyone connected in that situation with a demented patient, the decision might be made not to put her in the hospital. Now, I'm not advocating that, but if you say, put anyone in differently, I can easily imagine that language. So a lot, again, depends on the location of the patient. Is she in a nursing home connected to the Massachusetts General Hospital, or is she in a nursing home connected with, you know, no one?
I suppose the legal guardian once again found that not on the basis of what the patient said, but the guardian said, don't do it anymore. Do you argue with that?
In this situation, it would depend on, you know, what the legal guardian had information about the patient. Usually they have some kind of information, or they put you in touch with a family member who says, oh, I know. And to live for the past 10 years or so, let me die. So you're influenced, certainly, by the legal government, particularly since you don't know the patient and you can't communicate with the patient. But that's the role of the legal government, is to sort of take that responsibility and make it available to the doctor, which is essentially acting as a technician. There's no easy answer.
The answer that you just given, the new guardian says, let her die, and you really feel that she can get well. There's no serious problem here.
Again, I can just tell you how I would respond. I'm not saying that that's a lot of it.
No, but what you're saying is that even if the guardian would say no, you'll still
that's what he's asking. I think if the legal guardian said, let her die, I would try and make her as comfortable as possible, but not intercede aggressively to save her life. The main reason for me would be that she's demented. She has no cognizance of interacting with her.
How do you know the motivation of the legal guardian?
That's the problem. That's a whole other problem. That's why the ideal way, and, you know, advise my patient to do is send me in writing just what you want me to do. And if I'm still around and mentally competent when you're in that position, I will try and abide by your decision.
about the new fine in case of like that the patient changes his mind, because I thought that one should have been custody, and he doesn't think that. Even though there is this legal and there's papers saying that patient one wasn't comes to it, they change their mind.
Very true, but you can't make that assumption with a demented family.
But the family could.
Yeah, if they were a family, then that those would be the people that see even before the legal talk.
Yeah, but even if the patient, you have found the patient that has a family before saying that one to intervene, but the family has no doing to it, what do you follow the patient or the family?
A very tough question. It depends. Is the patient who I know from before, or who I've had a chance to talk to about these issues, I would have got there and the patient told me, not my family to tell me. If it's somebody who's a stranger who comes deposited in the emergency room door and I happen to be on duty at that shift, I would follow him.
Okay, let's move on to problem number three.
An 88-year-old woman with end-stage congestive heart failure is living with a niece. End-stage means that the heart is pretty well weakened beyond the point where it can be brought back to effective functioning. So this is a lady akin to the one in case one who doesn't have a lung full of fluid but has a small amount of fluid chronically present in the lung because the heart is not pumping effectively. She's bedbound and has very little appetite. Here at home, and she asks for assurance and she won't be hospitalized again. What should you tell her? So here's a lady whose mind is working. She has very advanced heart disease beyond the point where there's any practical way of reestablishing heart function. Now, maybe 100 years from now, heart transplantation would be available to 88-year-old ladies, but in this day and age, still rather difficult, generally reserved for much younger people who need it. And what would you tell her? I think what I would tell a lady like this, and maybe we should just ask a pretty good question for her. Anyone want to volunteer?
She shouldn't call.
I mean,
she shouldn't call.
The niece shouldn't call, she should call if something happens.
Well, I think the niece has to call because you want to treat this patient even if she doesn't go into the hospital to alleviate her pain and suffering to the extent that if she is going to be bed bound, then you might want to respect her wishes as far as not acting aggressively towards her. But on the other hand, she's entitled to care.
How can you be sure that she won't have that care?
Well, what I can say, assuming the niece and she are in agreement, there's no conflict between the niece who's the caretaker and the woman who's mentally alert and with it, but severely ill, fine. But I think the approach I would take is to agree with the lady that I would not hospitalize her against her wishes. When the event occurs, I would try and make her as comfortable as possible at home. If her pain relief, I would give her oxygen to ease her breathing. But that, I would stop there. Very practical sense, it probably wouldn't make any difference if I put her into the hospital under those circumstances. She wouldn't survive going to the hospital.
And furthermore, acting strongly against the wishes, maybe even hasten
her death. You'd be stressing her doing something that she doesn't want done. And her request is a perfectly reasonable request. So as long as the least wasn't there, the wish saying, oh, she's got to live on. In that situation, you have to deal with the niece and try to make peace with her over following the patient. But the patient is the primary decision.
What's the actual requirement of doctors that are supposed to save lives so they have this a certain legal requirement to intervene for this patient?
No, I don't think there's a legal requirement to save lives. I think there's a legal requirement. Are you talking about halakhic or those laws of Massachusetts?
No,
or the Hippocratic Oath?
Yeah, the Hippocratic Oath. I thought that they were obligated to do anything.
The obligation, at least the way I see it, is to save lives where possible and where not possible to conflict.
No, I'm not. Chris, I'm just curious, as a doctor, where your liability stands.
Frankly, again, I don't mean to sound callous, I don't really worry about my name.
Right.
I try and do what makes the most sense for the individual patient. I will care about my liability and that I won't go around doing what not to divorce me. Short of something extreme like that, I try
right,
and
so
serve the
patient. Right, so basically in the medical field, all this gray area is accepted, really.
Yes, you live with it day after day.
I would refer to the second conclusion, referring to the cost savings issues. And it says it intensifies the ethical issues. The way to intensify both of the issues we've talked about so far is supposing the hospital administrator says, I'm not asking you, you can't hospitalize the patient, or you can't treat the pulmonary edema in the demented woman. And you say, but I object, and you say, well, you're willing to give up on life, the patient doesn't like it, or for some other reason, so why, it's not absolute, so why are you making an issue out of that? And I think that's kind of the ethical issue that this panel is trying to deal with, saying that they insist that the primary decision be made on the basis of the doctor versus the patient, but that may be a decision that could be overridden by society at large by simply taking it out of the hands of the individual.
Further than
we are now. Case one, the reverse is also true. I mean, the scenario you gave, it's in a nursing home with no patient. You know, it's a doctor who's basically maybe employed by the nursing home. The nursing home may regard that patient as a source of revenue. You should need a profit center.
Well, I think, you know, the real golden rule is to follow the golden rule. Not treat the patient as an object, but
I mean, as we studied last time, I mean,